Would you take a new heart medication that hadn't been thoroughly tested and approved by the FDA? What about an untested vaccine for your newborn baby? Well, fortunately, the pharmaceutical industry is regulated to ensure that when new drugs come on the market, they've been tested, approved, and come with warnings of side effects and overall risk. But that's not true of most shampoos, detergents, and other common household cleaning products. The policy regarding industrial chemicals, which do not have to be tested before they're put on the market, is safe until proven dangerous. Here to discuss this non-policy and whether anything can be done to change it are Ian Urbina, an investigative reporter for The New York Times, whose article, "Think Those Chemicals Have Been Tested?" appeared in the Times' April 13th Sunday Review section. And returning to our show, a regular industrial hygienist, Monona Russell, author of Pick Your Poison, How Our Mad Dash to Chemical Utopia is Making Lab Rats of Us All. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of you back to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Monona, we have talked in the past about some of the dangerous chemicals in our household cleaning products. Can you remind us of what's under our sinks and in our showers and laundry rooms that we should be aware of?
Well, the rapid cleaners don't clean because they're water or soap. They clean because there are some very unique water-miscible solvents in them. The glycol ethers, for example, are common. And we know they go through the skin. That most of them, the ones that have been tested, show they have reproductive hazards. There's all kinds of issues with these chemicals. There are alcohols, other kinds of chemicals, odd chemicals we know nothing about that are in these products. The plain old ammonia, the plain old soap and water, those very limited hazards. But when we get to these fast cleaners and the fragrant ones and the natural ones, we have some pretty nasty chemicals under there, and many of them have not been tested for a long term. They may be tested for whether or not they'll burn a hole in you, but they will not be tested for whether or not years from now you'll have reproductive problems or cancer.
Does that apply to shampoos as well?
Shampoos come under FDA to some extent. So there's more likely to be certain testing for those. And when the product is used directly as a human maintenance product, there is. But when you're maintaining your sink, no.
Ian, can you give us a list of some of the possibly dangerous chemicals in commonly used products that haven't been tested?
I probably can't. I focused, rather than going broad, I went deep. And truthfully, what got me interested in the topic was one chemical in particular, which we wrote about previously, which is a common chemical used in workplaces. It's an industrial chemical. It's not as much a consumer chemical. It's called NPB, and it is a chemical that's in degreasing, so a lot of auto body shops, a chemical that's used. It's sold over the counter in sort of WD-40 type canisters to spray on, you know, things you may have in your garage that need and that have grease on them. It's used by dry cleaners to clean clothes and to remove spots, and it's also used in glue that a lot of workers use in making the cushions that we all sit on. So I actually was really interested in that one chemical, and what struck me as surprising in researching that one chemical was that, you know, the requirements on proving that it was safe just weren't there, and it was beholden to the federal government to really prove it was unsafe before it could be removed from the marketplace.
So what is bad about that chemical? Because it gets used so many different places.
Mm-hmm. So it's a neurotoxin, so it causes pretty severe, at low exposures over time, pretty severe nerve damage. And in the case of the workers that we looked at specifically, which was a collection of North Carolina factory workers who worked with the glue, these women, they were predominantly women, were losing control of their hands and feet after sometimes limited exposure, meaning several weeks if the exposures were acute. But it also has more recently, this chemical, been tied to, it's believed to be a carcinogen. It was categorized by the federal the relevant federal body at NIH as a probable carcinogen. So the evidence is sort of only now catching up with the use, and the evidence seems to be overwhelmingly pointing towards a range of dangers.
So if the NIH has said it's probably a carcinogen, does that mean that we're starting to see it banned, or is it still being used?
No. Yeah. One's going to ban it. Not for years and years. The problem is that the proof required to cause a ban is just almost unattainable. And the history with this chemical is the same as the history of just thousands of chemicals. This is just one. The exact same story could be told about normal hexane back in the 1980s. It also causes peripheral neuropathy. And no one knew that until people started to be unable to walk and unable to feel their hands. And this still isn't banned. So, you know, it's not going to happen. If they find a use for the chemical is going to be in our products. There's no requirement really for testing, and the only time we test anything is like this one, when there is a body count, when there is actual worker data. So if we are not the lab rats, if we the lab rats do not begin to create our own data, no one looks at any of these chemicals.
Are these ingredients listed on the labels of these products?
Doesn't matter. There's nothing to look up. You look up the chemical and you find out, hey, there's nothing known about this chemical.
The other point I would throw in on the question about a ban is that even if in the best of worlds it was easier to ban a chemical once you knew it was so dangerous, the problem with the kind of American marketplace right now is that something that's often referred to as regrettable substitutions. So it takes a while for the federal government. So, for example, there was a chemical called methylene chloride. The federal government sought to regulate that chemical because it was found to be very dangerous in workplaces, and a lot of workers were getting sick, and some were dying, and on average 30 a year. And so the OSHA, the Workplace Watchdog Agency, came in and really imposed a much stricter control on that chemical based on the evidence. It took a long time, 10 years to be exact, to get that control put in place. But once it was put in place, and in fact, a couple years before it was put in place, when the industry knew it was coming, they just moved over to a chemical that was newer and slightly different, but not hugely, and for which there was no pending regulation coming, and very little evidence and very little research. And so the marketplace moves much faster than regulations. And so the overall structural argument that's often made is that there needs to we need to put the horse and the cart in different spots and reverse the order of them. And so instead put the burden on proving that something is safe before it's allowed to be marketed rather than afterwards.
My guests are Ian Urbina, an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and industrial hygienist Monona Russell. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ian, what have you uncovered in your research regarding what companies know about the chemicals that they're putting into these products? Do they know that they're, in the cases that you cited, that the people who are working for them are getting sick?
No. No, they don't. And not only that, when there was a call to get this information and get this data, they said, well, we're going to require industry to release the studies they have. So the government was actually naive enough to think that if they did this, that industry was going to show that they really knew and that they have all kinds of data and all kinds of studies. No, they really don't. I think they came up with a total of 8,000 studies. Well, when this program started, I wrote down the number of registered chemicals from the Chemical Abstract Service, and it was 71,381,205. It is already up to 314 on the end of that number. So these are chemicals registered all over the world that are new, separate entities. If anyone takes even a year of organic chemistry, they will understand that the number of possible organic chemicals is essentially endless. And so if industry wants to substitute, they now have 21 million that are available by catalog for purchase. So there's no end to this. If we ban a chemical, we're wasting our time because there will be 15 chemicals in the waiting in the wings to take its place, most of which we know nothing about.
Ellen left this question on our show page. How do they address these issues with household and cosmetic uses of chemicals in the EU?
REACH. That's the new program that they have instituted.
So have they restricted some of these 71 million chemicals that you're talking about?
No, what they said is if it's manufactured in amounts over a ton a year and it's going to be used in consumer or industrial products in the EU, you have to register it, Mr. Manufacturer. So they registered 143,000 chemicals for those uses. But when they went through those chemicals, they found 30,000 of them that were high production volume. That means over 1,000 tons a year, on which there was essentially zero data. And so they said, well, these are the ones you have to start with. We want certain basic studies done on these. And I don't see that happening. My guess is that they're going to just be substituting chemicals for those and re-registering the new ones.
Ian, does government just look the other way? I'm thinking about this Texas fertilizer company explosion. They didn't heed the disclosure rules before the blast. Nobody seemed to be checking on what they were doing, and now many people are dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my impression of that blast is, I mean, if you look at when OSHA last visited that facility, it was in 86, I believe, 83. And so in some ways, that's a story of the oversight agency that's meant to check on safety of these locations really being structured such that they can't possibly pull that off.
That's right.
So
he's right.
There's very little chance that when you have roughly 8 million work sites in the U.S., many of them quite dangerous, one federal agency that's, responsible for half the states in the country, and then state agencies that do the same thing on a state level but are equally underfunded and constrained by certain limits on when they can visit and what justification they have to provide. It's not surprising that these sorts of problems can creep up. I think in the next couple of weeks it'll be interesting to see what reports come out from workers about any warning signs that were or were not there.
But this covers both Republican and Democratic administrations. We had Cass Sunstein on the show fairly recently. He was Obama's regulation czar, and he said he worked to make regulation more efficient. How has oversight or regulation changed under President Obama?
The only thing I see is that he at least put people at the heads of the agencies who actually know something about that particular subject.
But we still have this explosion in
Texas. That is a revolution.
But we still had this explosion in Texas. And
well, that's EPA really primarily. And they did their last inspection of that factory in 2006 and were never told and never knew, really, that that's what was being held there. They cited them for failure to have any safety program, what the heck ever. So what they did is they wrote up a safety program, West Fertilizer did, and it said that the only worst scenario problem they had was evacuation after a release of anhydrous ammonia. And they never mentioned the fact that they were holding tons of one of the most explosive chemicals going, which is ammonium nitrate.
Now, some chemicals have been banned, chlorofluorocarbons. Are they the exception to the rule?
But they weren't banned because they're bad for our health.
They're bad for the environment?
They're some of the safest chemicals you can ever snort. The problem with those is they go up to the ozone layer and almost for years and years can keep tearing up the ozone layer. So they're banned only for purposes of that ozone layer issue, and they're actually banned only in the EPA has a whole series of different freon type of chemicals. So the ones that you're using now will not be used in 10 years. Those you will not be using in 10 years because they're trying to get things that are better and better and better for the environment. But they are the new ones are actually more toxic to people than the ones that they replaced.
And in doing your piece, what did you see as OSHA's role in all of this?
Well, it's complicated. So in the piece that we wrote, looked specifically at this one chemical and one use of it, and really honed in on one community where it was being used. So this was in North Carolina, and there was one company in particular that makes these foam cushions for seats, and a sort of deep look at the history of that company and the struggles it had to, number one, cut costs and continue to compete in light of foreign competition, especially from China, that has really especially battered this state and this industry.
Do the Chinese use the same chemical?
They do, yeah. Most of this chemical is being imported now from China, and to the extent that foam cushion work is occurring in China, it's occurring with the same chemical, with far fewer regulations. So, but the responsibility in our story had different tiers. So in North Carolina, it's a state that's run by state OSHA. It's a state that has been deputized essentially by the federal government to run its own program. And on the one hand, the state OSHA office was actually comparatively aggressive compared to other states when it came to attempting to police this chemical. They knew it was a problem. They knew it was dangerous. They'd put out a health hazard. They visited this one company that had serious problems over and over again, more so than the feds had actually visited any single facility. On the other hand, the visits were largely ineffective because the fine structure was low and they systematically lowered the fines. And state OSHA often underestimated its own authority to actually force the company to change its ways. And in the end, the state officials also wanted to, I think, legitimately be mindful of being too burdensome on the company because half of this industry had already gone abroad. And this was, like many companies in the state, a teetering business.
But if people were getting sick, doesn't the state of North Carolina have to pay for some of their medical treatment?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, there are costs on either side, though, because an unemployed person, is a burden to the state. It's an ethical consideration, and it's also, a health consideration. But a person who is employed and yet gets sick ends up also being a burden in many of the same ways. So there are always these tough calls to make. And in the case of this company, it, at least in our reporting, seemed pretty clear that the calls were not properly balanced. And there were, dozens of workers who were getting sick over a long period of time. And the agency was not improving, was not sufficiently applying leverage. And the company was still in business. So clearly the calibration was off there. But truth be told, the story of that company and that state might as well have been writ large. So the very same problems that we saw there were also on the federal level, in the sense that federal OSHA is equally hamstrung, but also equally prone to focusing on these explosions. Like in Texas, the acute sort of headline-grabbing and dramatic and often fatal accidents, at the expense of dedicating attention to the slower, creeping, more chronic threats that, in the end, kill a lot more American workers than these acute, fatal accidents.
So what happens to these workers? Do they wind up going on workman's compensation, and then the company just brings in new people to replace them?
Yeah, because it doesn't cost the employer hardly anything, because he isn't paying the $400 a week or the $600 a week here in New York for full disability. That's coming. It just means his insurance, his comp insurance, kicks up a tick. So it really doesn't. It doesn't cost him anything to disable a worker. Really, it's the taxpayer that picks up that chunk.
In the case of North Carolina, just to answer that question, though, it's a little bit more complicated because actually it did, I mean, to some degree, I think it's true that it doesn't cost the employer. In the case of the company we looked at, they, in the end, actually resisted paying workers' comp, and in most of these instances, they were sued by their workers to get workers' comp. And in most of the cases, the company ended up paying more in legal fees and settlement costs than they would have if they had just allowed for workers' comp. And so in some ways, it's a story of, again, not a pure cost-benefit analysis, but more a, are you going to think about the cost over the 10 years, or are you going to think about it just this year? When the time frame matters for these institutions, and when you look at the company over the past 10 years, it looks like very irrational decisions. But if you actually look at the company from within how the company operates, which is usually on a sort of day-to-day, hand-to-mouth, we're barely surviving, we just have to figure out what to do this month sort of mentality, that's when they're actually not smart decisions, but they aren't irrational. They're just trying to keep their head above water that year, and that's why they're making some calls that don't make much sense all told.
My guests are Ian Urbina, an investigative reporter for the New York Times. His article, Think Those Chemicals Have Been Tested, appeared in the Times April 13th Sunday Review section. Also with us is industrial hygienist Monona Russell. Her latest book, Pick Your Poison, How Our Mad Dash to Chemical Utopia is Making Lab Rats of Us All. And we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Monona Russell, author of a number of books, including Pick Your Poison, How Our Mad Dash to Chemical Utopia is Making Lab Rats of Us All, and Ian Urbina, who is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. We've talked about other issues that he has covered, but today we're talking about what he wrote about in Think Those Chemicals Have Been Tested, which appeared in the Times April 13th Sunday Review section. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's go to Joe from Manhattan. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is such that given the overlap with the Boston incident, I was still surprised to see the limited amount of information that was readily available within the first 24 hours of the accident in Texas. Usually when this kind of a large-scale incident occurs, we know everything about the chain of custody of the ownership of the corporation, a lot more information, a lot more details than we, even to this day, almost a week after, are now learning. And I'm just curious as to why there is such limited information about this company, its history, its background, and its ownership, and what's happening.
Ian, you work for the Times.
If only I was an editor, then I would answer that question. But I'm not. I haven't been covering the story, so I don't have a good answer for you. I mean,
know how decisions are made at newspapers, and I don't want to pick on the New York Times, but isn't it usually that one story just takes over, and even if some other terrible thing happens, it gets buried because of the one story? For example, in Texas, a lot more people died than died in the Boston Marathon. I mean, they're both terrible things, and they both perhaps carry equal weight as tragedies.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to guess the answer, I would say, there was a lot of attention on the Boston tragedy.
There's another problem there. You have no idea how perceptive his question really was. One of the problems is that it was in Texas. I've worked in Texas and many, many, many other states, and they have almost a religious anti-regulatory attitude there. And companies are extremely unforthcoming. It's not surprising that OSHA knew very little and that the ownership, all those things are kept very close to the belt. It is extremely difficult to investigate accidents in that state. I know because I've done expert witness there a number of times. So it's always a problem, but it's just more of a problem when it's an industrial situation, because they do keep things close to the belt anyway. And when it's in a state that is really anti-regulatory, it just complicates the process. So it was a very good question on the part of your listener.
Did you find...
only thing I would add to that is, at the time specifically, and sort of in news organizations, I can say, when there's a story that has national and international importance, it's always going to get more resources, as this one did. This is a national security story. It was potentially an international story with the Chechen angle. It was a national story in the sense of it wasn't clear what sort of attack it was. So whereas, as tragic as Texas was, it was a isolated event, and there was no thought that this was part of a larger terrorism concern. So.
Now, there are national laws. What is the Toxic Substances Control Act?
So TSCA was passed in 1976. It's the relevant law that really is regulated by the EPA, and it sort of is meant, in theory, to control how industrial chemicals are vetted for safety before put on the market. And it, in essence, is what many believe needs to be updated, since it's one of the few laws of its type that hasn't been updated since the 70s.
Well, isn't there a new law that's been proposed, the Safe Chemicals Act of 2013? Is it likely to pass with the current anti-regulation environment in Washington?
I wouldn't think so. This is Mononic. I wouldn't think it's going to pass.
What does it call for?
It's a very complicated and very interesting act. But basically, there is a list of chemicals, usually about 200, of the ones they're most concerned about, that they require testing of within a certain period of time, and they require certain types of tests. The problem, again, is that industry can keep up so much faster than that with new chemicals that we really need to kind of approach it differently. I certainly back the bill because it's better than nothing, but we really need to turn it around and say that when you substitute for one of these toxic chemicals, you have to provide the basic toxicology for that chemical before it's used as a replacement.
Have either of you looked into the competing legislation that Senator David Vitter, the Republican from Louisiana, is planning to introduce?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a little bit on that. I mean, I think to some degree what may... So the two laws, Lautenberg's law and then Vitter's law, I think may end up canceling each other out. And this is sort of a test case of Congress being so split. At root, the major difference between the two laws is in where it places the burden to prove safety. So in Vitter's law, and it's not released yet, but you know, from what people are saying, it would aim to do, it would keep the burden significantly on the shoulders of the federal government to prove something was unsafe before it was removed from the market. In Lautenberg's law, so Vitter's law bill has stronger support from the chemical industry, in large part because the chemical industry is very worried that. You know, any sort of new regulations will, number one, be redundant, number two, potentially sort of squelch innovation, and three, be costly on industry, putting the burden on industry to prove safety prior to marketing will, you know, slow down our competitive advantage vis-a-vis other countries.
So they'd be allowed to put these chemicals into the products. People would get sick, and then they'd say, oops, sorry, we didn't test them.
Yep. Well, those are your words, but the Vitter bill would definitely be a continuation of the current. There are some changes, but to a large degree it would be an extension of the current situation. And what you described is one version of what that.
Well, that's how it would work. Yeah. I understand. Mark from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? Good afternoon. I just had a couple of comments and a quick question.
Well, could you make it real quick because we don't have much time?
Okay, first of all, I would like to say on Earth Day, real men love Mother Nature, and I would like to send my condolences and prayers out to my brother, first responders down there in Texas. My best friend's older brother is in charge of an organic and biodynamic soap factory in Germany. And I was wondering if the same regulations that exist in Europe would, can we trust here in the United States household detergents and cleaning compounds that tout themselves as being organic or all natural?
Or non-toxic or eco-friendly. Are they all safe, Monona?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the word natural should be a red flag. Some of the most toxic chemicals are manufactured by Mother Nature. The citrus oil cleaners and some of the other, turpentine, those kinds of chemicals are toxic, sensitizing, very dangerous.
Oh, yeah, the things that have odors, the orange, the cleansers that have orange flavors or whatever, they are dangerous? Lemon, fresh, pledge?
If it contains D-limonene, yes, the major ingredient in citrus oil. In fact, it will actually increase the formaldehyde levels in your house because they react with pollution levels of ozone in your home.
They're called polynuclear or aromatic hydrocarbons?
No, they create the surface of those terpenes react with ozone to create formaldehyde.
Ah. Well, so I guess there's no way to prevent being exposed to all of these things.
Yeah, I think we should be going back to simpler cleaners, soap and water and simple things. It would just make a lot of sense.
Ian, you have anything to say before we end this in just a few seconds?
I would just say it does seem like as Europe pushes towards REACH, its new sort of model, it is raising the bar on what multinational companies have to do. And they're having to make hard decisions. If they're going to put a product out there, they don't want to have two different versions. So if the Europeans raise the bar on safety higher, it's probably going to have a positive impact. It may have a positive impact
here
in the U.S.
Thank you both so much. Ian Urbina, The New York Times, Monona Russell, thank you again.